giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hello and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. I am not your normal host. I'm Chad Pytel, and today I'm turning the tables on our normal host, Benjamin Orenstein, and asking him some questions. Hey, Ben.
Woo! Hello. I am excited.
Hopefully, I do anywhere near a good job interviewing you as you interview our guests. You've set the bar very high. So.
Oh, thank you. This is a nice podcast for me because it required no prep time for the first in like 84 podcasts.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, so what do you do to prep for the podcast?
I try to show up knowing a decent amount about the guest already. So when I'm asking questions, it's rarely to sort of gather general biographical data. It's more like, I think there's probably an interesting answer here. I think it makes the guests feel a little flattered as well. And it's like nice to have a familiarity with their work. So I start by Googling them. If they have a Twitter feed, I check out what they've been talking about for the last few weeks. I look if they're active on GitHub, if they're a programmer type. If they have been blogging, I try to read at least a handful of their last blog posts. Pretty much anything they've published on the internet, I want to at least have passing familiarity with. Some people have talks online, which is great too, because I'll sort of skim that and see what they're into and what their presenting style is like.
I think it was, is it James Lipton, the guy?
Inside the Actors Studio.
He says that you never ask a question you don't already know the answer to when doing interviews. That's one of his techniques. That could also have been a parody of him that I'm just remembering.
that could be. I definitely ask, sometimes I ask questions to which I don't know the answer. But I sometimes am asking leading questions because I think the answer is going to be cool.
Right. So we're sticking on the podcast for a little while. Mm-hmm. You know, you participate somewhat in the scheduling and all that stuff. Other people do that. Other people do the recording and the editing, and you participate in that process. But you really are focused on the interviewing. And how does that feel?
I like it. I'm happy to be the dumb talent that doesn't really know how the rest of the thing works. I remember you approached me back when we started this because you were like, we're thinking about starting a podcast. We think you might be good at hosting it. What do you think? And at first, to me, I thought that meant I was going to be like tracking down guests and doing the editing and all that. And I was kind of not that psyched about that idea. And you're like, no. You just show up and record it. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that I'm into.
Yeah.
So the additional work is not as much doesn't interest me as much. I like talking to the guests.
Yeah.
So I feel okay being disconnected from it. And everyone else does a good job. Like we've always outsourced that or delegated that to people that know what they're doing. So I'm okay with it.
Totally.
Yeah. Except for when you were producing it. That was a little bit of a mess.
It was very iffy.
We needed adult supervision, but fortunately we hired somebody after a while.
Right. Maybe that's all we'll talk about the podcast.
Maybe it is.
Maybe.
Maybe I'll force us back there.
Yeah.
I'm the guest now. I can control the flow.
So how did you get started with programming? Take us back to a young Benjamin Orenstein.
Yeah. I had fooled around with like Gorilla.base, like the Q basic programs really, really simple stuff. But I got my real start when I was a senior in high school. So I had moved during high school, and for whatever reason, the classes I had taken in my previous school put me more or less a year ahead of my peers at my new school, just by sort of happenstance. And so I reached my senior year, and I'd actually finished all of my requirements to graduate. And so I had a guidance counselor suggest that I do what was called, or what I think still is called, dual enrollment. So I actually went to UMass Lowell for a year as my senior year of college, senior year of high school, doing a full course load there. And I had an incredible professor, Dr. James Canning, who ran the like Computing 101 course, which is like, you know, this is your first CS, computer science course. And I really liked him because like I had never been an amazing student. I'd never been like a particularly motivated student. And I went into his class and sat down, and there were 300 people in the lecture hall. And he said, this is one of the hardest classes on campus. He said, about 70 of you will finish this class. I'm probably going to lose about 100 of you after this lecture alone. I give out at most one or two A's per semester. So if you are not ready to work hard and you're one of those people that hates not getting A's, this is a terrible class for you. And indeed, like 50 people dropped after that lecture. But I was like totally motivated by that. And so he handed out on the first day a stack of paper that was 110 programming challenges that went from incredibly basic all the way up to fairly involved. And the class was taught in C. That throwdown of like, you probably can't get an A in this course was like more motivating to me than anything I'd ever experienced in my academic career. And so I started tackling the problem sets, and he was an awesome lecturer. And that was like really what showed me that I could love doing this mm-hmm. thing.
Now, you realize it will be a perfect ending to the story if you then went on to get an A in the class.
I actually did get an A. And one of my proudest moments was we took the first midterm or the first sort of exam that he gave. And he saw me in the hallway and he stopped and he shook my hand and said, you got 100. And I was like, yeah. And this guy was like my hero. So like the fact that he knew me and recognized that that was my test and like I did well, I was really psyched.
So this isn't about me, but I'm learning new things about you. I didn't realize that you did dual enrollment. I did too my senior year.
Oh.
But just for CS. So my school didn't have any CS classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Massachusetts, you had the option if you don't have classes in a subject you want to take, you can dual enroll in order to take them.
Okay.
And so that's what I did
mm-hmm.
and took a class in C, Intro to C Programming. And the professor, again, was very inspiring. We called him the human compiler because he could look at a lot of the course was just written on paper.
Hmm. Yep.
We didn't do it at computers.
Hmm.
And he could
look at... Computers
had not been invented. It was an amazing... amazing course. Yeah. I don't know how they even knew that there would be such things as computers.
Sure.
But he would look at printouts or what we had written and just be able to tell us what the problems were.
Yeah. It was interesting to me how contagious that enthusiasm for the course was
mm-hmm.
because, like I said, I was never much of a student, never super motivated about it. But then like because I was so psyched up for that class, I ended up infecting the other classes I was doing. It's like I had like these really amazing grades when I was doing dual enrollment that were whereas before I had been sort of middling. And it was awesome to me to have a professor with that level of inspiration. I'd never really experienced that before.
Yeah.
And also C. It was cool to like start off with something really close to the metal. I didn't know that at the time,
mm-hmm.
but it's nice to have that knowledge kind of in the back of my head of how these things work at a slightly lower level.
Right. So is that when you decided to what you were going to go to school for?
I decided that about 10 years before then. my dad was involved in the high-tech industry. He was in sales, but he was like selling like microchips to like IBM and things like that. And so he brought home an 8086 computer when I was pretty young. And I have never fallen in love with something so quickly. I was just like instantly smitten. And I was like, this is the best thing ever. All I want to do is this thing. And so I had my eye on computer science for quite some time before that.
Yeah. So you then went on to computer science. Where did you go to school?
I went to UMass Amherst for a period of time. I did not end up graduating. I think I was a great example of someone who should have taken some time off before school. So I had that good experience at UMass Lowell. It somehow didn't transfer once I got like out of the house.
Yeah.
Not a lot of maturity. And as I said, like I wasn't a great student in high school. So then like I got to UMass Lowell and I started UMass Amherst and I started as a sophomore. And so like that's where you hit all the nasty weeder classes, mm-hmm. like assembly language and compilers and Calc 3 and all these. Like I basically had a nasty workload as my very first semester, and I pretty much cratered. I didn't have the work habits to be able to tackle that much work at that level.
Yeah. I'm from right near there, and there's a nickname for UMass Amherst. Do you know what it is?
Is it ZooMass?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I lived on the computer science floor.
Okay,
so it was a little tamer than mm-hmm. usual, and like I guess I kind of was a partier. I don't know. To me, it wasn't so much that the distractions that were hurting me; it was a lack of good habits,
mm-hmm.
and a strong procrastination habit, and also I used to get fairly overwhelmed with big projects, and that's probably where the procrastination came from. So they would hand out these things that were meant to be multi-week problem sets. And like every time I thought about starting, it would just like intimidate me. And so I would fail to start until, you know, too late when the panic of not doing it overcame the panic of I probably can't do this.
Right.
And then, you know, I'm trying to last minute all these things and not succeeding.
Yeah. That was pretty common in my program, too. You'd end up in the lab the night before.
Yeah.
And pulling all-nighters. And the whole class was there. So it wasn't that bad.
Yeah. At least it was social.
Right. At least it was social. So what happened now? So was deciding to, well, did you fail out or drop out?
I failed out, actually. Okay. I was dismissed for academic deficiency, and they said, let's see other people for a while. And so you can, after that, you basically have to take a, so it's basically a forced semester off, at which point you can reapply. Mm-hmm. But I realized I was not in the place to reapply. So that was like pretty much actually rock bottom for me. That was when I went and I went home, moved home, and I got a job, and I was working as a bartender at the Olive Garden. And I had like special non-slip shoes and a uniform and a name tag and like working for like an extremely corporate restaurant chain. And it was like, it was terrible. I was very sad at that point. I was like fairly ashamed at what I had done. And I had like this moment of like my ex-girlfriend from high school like came in and saw me here. I was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, just, you know, doing some work, hanging out. And it was like terrible. But it didn't last very long, fortunately. So I kind of started digging myself out of the hole. I got a better job. It was still in a restaurant, but it was like at a better restaurant. And then I had done some IT internships when I was in high school, like doing network stuff. And so I managed to land an IT consulting job after probably about 6 months after leaving or getting kicked out of school. And then turned that into my first programming job, and then turned that into my first Rails job, and then turned that into Thoughtbot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really painful, and it sucked, but the trajectory was fairly consistently up. So I just kind of had to hit that and experience the pain, I think, to sort of reset my, like, what do I care about? What's worth doing? How can I do it?
Right. Have you ever felt like, beyond that initial slump, have you ever felt like not having a degree hurt you?
I don't think so. I'm very fortunate to have chosen the field that I did, where it's sort of not an issue. I think There are definitely some companies where they wouldn't talk to me because of the lack of degree. But almost even all those companies now these days say, like, you know, CS degree or equivalent work experience
right. Type
thing. And a lot of companies don't even care. Like, we didn't talk about my degree status at all.
Well, you wrote a blog post about how we didn't even ask you for a resume.
That's true. Yeah. You didn't. Not only did I not need a degree, I didn't need a resume. It was, you know, personal connections. I had done a Rails Rumble with Dan Croak, and I had, you know, a blog with a lot of stuff on it, mm-hmm. and a GitHub with some things on it, too.
It's so easy. You know, it's much harder to get. We don't hire entry-level people. I think if you were trying to get an entry-level job here, just starting out, it'd be very hard. You'd have nothing to show.
Right.
But for us, it's so easy to look at what people have done or can do. Just say, sit down at this computer and do something. And it's very easy for us to not worry about degrees, not worry about resumes.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a strength of our industry.
Right.
Like, and there are many other industries where the degree becomes proof that of competency when it really isn't.
Right.
We're lucky in that way, I think.
Right. I think that also translates to learning. So my wife is a material scientist. You know, working at home, she can't do her actual work at home.
Mm.
We don't have a lab in our house with hoods and, you know, all this stuff. And so I think we're very fortunate to be able to just crack open the laptop at home and do what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I decided I wanted to get into Rails. I was working at a company in this proprietary language, and I was very unhappy. Like, I was happy to be writing software at least, but it was very much not the right company or field for me. And I was able to, in my own time, teach myself Rails at home enough that I could sort of be fairly well spoken in an interview, enough to land a Rails job that was admittedly entry level, but, you know, got me in the door.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very lucky in a lot of ways in this field, I think, to be able to have such easy evaluations of our work, and also to be able to do it ourselves and have all the materials we need, learning materials and also like materials of production are easily available.
Yeah. So when did you start in that progression? When did you start doing test-driven development?
Ooh, I had a test-driven epiphany when I was, I did fairly quickly go back to taking classes like online or part-time because I was figured out why not to chip away at the degree. And so I was taking a compilers course at UMass Boston this time in my effort to go to every single UMass related institution. And so that class was actually great. I learned a lot. And one of the best things I learned was he made us do, not TDD, but he made us write tests.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was writing a compiler, and a compiler is like a pipeline where like you start with a program, and you know the first thing you do is you parse it out into tokens, and then you combine the token, or you split it out into tokens, you parse it together to figure out what it means, then you generate the code. And so there's this like fairly long involved pipeline with a number of steps. And I remember so distinctly writing these tests because we had to. We literally were graded on them, but like thinking like, I don't really get why we're doing this. And then one day I broke something. I changed something fairly early on in the compilation process, probably in the Lexer or the tokenizer. And then something way, way down the pipeline broke. Mm-hmm. And the test blew up. And I was like, why is this test suddenly failing? And I realized I had this like little error way, way like further back in the pipeline. And I had this moment of like, oh my God, like this would have been broken for weeks. Mm-hmm. And it would have tripped me up so badly on something else entirely. And I have no idea how this change got here, or you know, why it suddenly was not working. And I had that moment of like, oh my God, this is the best idea ever. And then I became pretty obsessed with the tests. Mm.
So when you started learning Rails, then you started with TDD right away?
Yes and no. When I was doing my very first applications, no.
Right.
I knew I wanted tests, but like it still felt too hard to mm-hmm. write tests in the beginning. I was still like fiddling with things and seeing what broke. But pretty quickly, I knew I wanted to go that way. So I started learning a little bit of testing on that. And then I was fortunate my first Rails job, they had a strong TDD environment. So
I learned the same way. It's in fact, the way that we teach Rails is just to focus on Rails
mm-hmm.
and then learn testing. You have too much to learn up front. It's very intimidating.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I learned the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Learned at Thoughtbot, actually, because Thoughtbot had already existed before Rails.
Mm.
So then along that progression, when did you pick up Vim?
I actually picked up Vim during that same compilers course.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good friend who is like one of those, he doesn't technically have a neck beard, but he's really good in the shell kind of guys. And he was a heavy Vim user. His name is Stu Powers. And he was like, you should try out Vim. And I was like, I don't know. I got this Eclipse thing over here and like it does all this stuff for me. And he was like, just try out Vim. And so I did. And I started with Vim Tutor. And I was hooked in like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. It was like the mnemonics make so much sense. Like it's a language for editing text and there's verbs and there's nouns and like I get it. And every time I learned like a new thing, it just like fit so nicely into the existing framework. And like it just felt, I remember being very impressed at how good the design was. Like I felt like I just kept having these moments of like the people who wrote this are so smart. This makes so much sense. I totally am with, I can be in their minds and understand mm-hmm. why they chose, you know, D for this and C for that. And I like, it was just, it was a great moment.
Yeah.
So I switched from Eclipse to Vim during that course. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was, of course, a little bit painful at first, but then pretty quickly was like, okay, this is awesome.
Right. One of our listeners asked how long it took you to get to Vim mastery. And I know what your answer is going to be. So I'm just going to ask the question like that, and then you can answer it how I think you're going to answer
it. You're using my interview technique. It's so... I feel cringy when people call me a Vim master. I feel very cringy. Partly because Vim is one of those things that A, you'll never really master, but B, like I work with people here that are clearly more skilled with Vim than I am. I've developed this reputation because I went and talked about it, and I've given a couple of Vim-related talks and things like that. And to people that are much less experienced, it probably seems like I am a Vim master. But right. like I have nothing but awareness of how little I know in relation to Vim, you know, the entirety of Vim, and also even other people that sit next to me on right. a daily basis.
Right.
But the way I did it was just kind of caring about it. I'm a little bit of an efficiency junkie. I like getting things done with two keystrokes instead of three whenever possible. And so I just sort of always put a little bit of effort in fairly consistently mm-hmm. to learning it. And then I decided to teach it too. And that was actually my like inroad to speaking. That was my first talk ever, was a Vim talk at RailsConf.
Right.
And so I realized, hey, I have a lot of specialized knowledge in this thing. So this can kind of be the wedge I use to pry the door open. So when I decided to teach stuff, I, of course, learned more, as you mm-hmm. always do.
Mm-hmm. You did write a blog post, though, that said, give it 2 weeks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. Was that the Vim learning curve is a myth?
Yes.
Post? Yeah. I think in the post I said that 2 weeks is when you pass your previous speed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what that is. You can learn enough Vim to get work done by just running through the Vim tutor, which takes about 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And then, yes, you are going to be slower for a little bit, but people, I think, drastically overestimate how long that will take.
Yeah.
So I think it's about 2 weeks, and then you're like, okay, yeah, I wouldn't go back. I'm faster now.
There's a line in that blog post that I see come up on Twitter every once in a while, because it's very quotable. It's the Street Fighter line.
Yeah. It's something like people say, I could never learn Vim. There are too many keystrokes or too many commands.
No one ever says, I don't like Street Fighter. There are too many combos or something.
Right. Or like, I'm not going to learn Street Fighter because there are too many combos.
Right.
Right. It's like you start and you know the rudiments. Like, you can punch and you can kick and jump, and like, you cannot combine them in any interesting ways. But like, it doesn't prevent you from playing the game and having a good time. And then you slowly gain fluency.
So you mentioned speaking. That's how you got into speaking. It was your first speaking, and you jumped right to the top of the pile at RailsConf. It's been mentioned before. There's an episode with Chad Fowler, who was running RailsConf at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
How you got that. But let's maybe just recap a little bit.
Yeah. So I have a couple life viewpoints or lessons, I guess, that come from my dad. So my dad has been in sales for his whole life. So he's sort of specialized in like getting what he wants from people at a high level. And so there's a couple things that he sort of instilled in me. And one of them is, going in the front door is kind of like low probability. If you take the path that everyone else is taking, your odds of success tend to be fairly low. But if you can be a little bit creative and step outside that, you can often really raise your odds for success. So when I applied to RailsConf, I think they even said, like, you know, we get about 120 applications for 40 slots or something along those lines. And I had no prior public speaking experience. And so I knew I was sort of fighting, and I had no name recognition or anything like that. So I knew I was fighting an uphill battle. And so I wrote and recorded the first 5 minutes of the talk I wanted to give. So I just turned on my webcam and pretended I was giving. I put on a nice shirt and then put some Vim books in the background and gave the first 5 minutes of my talk. And then I sent that link to, I didn't know who it was, but it's like hello@railsconf.org or something. And said, I would love to give this talk. I know you don't know who I am, so I recorded this so you could see what my speaking style is like. I'm totally fired up. I'm going to do a great job. You know, either way, I'll see you there. Thanks for thinking of me. And it was like 30 minutes later, Chad Fowler responded. And I was like, oh my God, Chad Fowler responded to me. And forwarded to my parents and whatnot. But he was like, I love the video idea. This is really cool. Thanks for getting in touch. I can't promise anything, but like, we'll give your application an extra special look. Which is like, you know, all you can ask for. And to me, it was code for, you got this. You know, we're fine. We're going to accept you because you did a good job. And it worked. And then he later wrote a blog post about this experience. And to me, it was just all about, it wasn't even that it was particularly hard. It really took me like half an hour.
Right.
But it was that it put me outside of the normal path. It wasn't, or outside the pack. It wasn't just like I was application 45 out of 120. I was like the guy that sent in the video. And that's what I'm always recommending to people that I mentor or that are new in the Rails world. There is like, try to find some way to stand out and like be the guy or the gal that did this something,
right?
And just give yourself it gives you such a huge edge when you're not just try to put yourself in the shoes of the person who's reading all these proposals and has read 10 already and is going to read 10 more before they take a break because their mind is dead. And like, how are you going to stand out from that, from the previous ones?
So you've gone all the way from speaking at RailsConf to now you're organizing one of the tracks for this year's conference.
Yeah, totally.
The live coding track?
Yep. Yeah, I'm very psyched about this. Marty Hot? Hout? Hot?
Hot.
Hot. Marty Hot approached me.
I hope.
Yeah, I hope so. Marty is hot, though. He approached me via email, as people do, and said, hey, would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. So, it's interesting because this is the opposite of my podcast approach, where now I'm not the talent, I'm the person doing the organization. Mm-hmm. But it felt cool. I'm very critical of conferences, at least in my head and in private. They often make choices that I, you know, disagree with, and I'm fairly I set a high bar for speaking quality and ability and all that. And you know, I'm always, of course, nice to people and in public, but in my head sometimes I get a little judgy. And so I thought it was a nice opportunity to try to affect the outcome of a conference.
Right. And specifically, you're doing the live coding track. I know that you firmly believe that people should live code during their talk.
Yeah, it's not the right format for everything. Right. But I think it's weird. Like, it's imagine you have a conference of painters and you have a ton of presentations and not a single person does any painting.
Right.
It's like, I mean, okay, you can still definitely learn stuff. And there are some things that wouldn't make sense to show by painting. But if you put in a master up on the or someone awesome up on stage and everyone just watched them paint, they would probably learn a few things. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of, I find the information stream is richer when people are watching each other work. Because it's like, as opposed to here's a slide with the finished product on it, it's like, let's get to the finished product. And along the way, you realize, oh, he runs his test from inside the editor. Oh, he has a shell alias for that thing that I do all the time. Oh, he doesn't switch to the console or to his shell to switch Git branches or to make a commit. He uses this cool Vim plugin. You just learn a lot of these little things that are process related in there.
One of the reasons why I hear people say that you should never live code during a talk is because it can be so error prone.
Yep.
And I think honestly, that's just because of lack of preparation and doing it at the last minute. And going in and making a change at the last minute.
It's for sure harder. If you want to do less work, definitely do not do live coding. It takes me about 10 times as long to prepare a live coding talk as something if I were going to use slides, for sure. Because you have to practice the crap out of it to have any sort of confidence. And even after those tons of practice, I found that when I was giving like my refactoring from good to great talk, it got way better as I gave it at more conferences. Mm-hmm. Like you need live practice to really master this. Mm-hmm. So it is for sure. If you value your time more than everything else, you know it's not a good choice. But it's you can get it very unerror prone by practicing the crap out of it. And also it's funny to think one mindset is if I make a single mistake, people will think I'm bad at this, and you know it's going to be awkward and I'll be stuck and frozen. The other way of thinking of it is there are 100 people there to help you fix any errors. Mm-hmm. So when I did occasionally run into something that I wasn't expecting in my talks that are live coding, I say, what's wrong? And someone always has already seen it. Mm-hmm. It's like you have 98 people pairing with you. So it's actually a really easy way to rescue yourself from errors is to just ask the audience, like, well, how do we fix this? What's going on here?
Mm-hmm. So for the live coding talks, you said you do 10 times more preparation. What does your idea and then preparation process look like?
For live coding talks, it all comes down to the examples and where you can take them. So it's I think choosing examples for like blog posts and for live coding in particular are like really is kind of the magic. It's the hardest part, I think, actually. Too simple, and it's people can't see how it applies to their real work, and they say, well, of course it works in this scenario, but it would never be valid in the real world. And too complicated, and people get sort of lost in the details. You'll never get it perfect because if it's, people will always think it's too simple or too complicated, no matter. But so I try to find really good examples and start with there. And with the live coding, it's really nasty. I'll try to start with some code that I think looks reasonable but has some problems, and then think about where I can take it. And as I go, I sort of write down the series of steps that I'm doing. And constantly find I got stuck in this thing. Back up a couple, try a different thing. I got this. This is not very clear. Back up, change the example. It's very iterative. It requires a lot of redoing stuff.
So on average, how long would you say that you prepare for a talk before giving it for the first time?
It's weird. So it depends on it. The live coding stuff I said takes way longer than it does. Mm-hmm. It's probably 25 hours or something of prep, something along those lines. From start to finish, and that's just for the first iteration, the first time I give it, which is never as good as the later times. For other stuff, it's shorter. So the talk I did at RailsConf most recently about how to talk to developers was sort of a soft talk. So I was giving tips on speaking. That I prepped in about 2 or 3 hours.
And you gave it a couple times. What does your prep process look like?
I speak it out loud in my hotel room.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. So I work from notes and then I just sort of talk from the notes and it's more or less free form. Those are there for guidance, but
I remember for that one you had index cards or not? Mm-hmm. No. Okay.
I pretty much always print out the talk on just 8.5
by
11.
It was a piece of paper. Okay. It was 8.5 by 11 sheets. Yeah.
And just leave it there on the lectern or the podium. So that one was a bit of an anomaly because it was a topic that I had thought about so much and had even started an ebook on and was really passionate about. So it was pretty easy to figure out what I wanted to go in there. And it was mostly about, again, coming up with good examples.
So in that talk, you gave a lot of examples for how to speak well, to give good talks. And, I think by highlighting what you think makes a good talk, you also highlighted what you think makes a bad talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think combining the concept of preparation with those techniques that you outlined
mm-hmm.
is the recipe for how to give a good talk. And when you see oftentimes a talk that was not good, it's because of lack of preparation and a lack of just simple speaking, public speaking practices.
Totally. I definitely agree. People seem to, so one of the things I said not to do in my talk is don't pre-apologize. Mm-hmm. And people love to pre-apologize in particular and say, oh, I was up till 2 working on these slides. Or like, oh, I hope I get this because I just changed this like 5 minutes ago. And it's like, well, you are sort of a jerk.
Right.
Because you have traded my time for your own. Like you're going to make me sit through a talk that is sort of hastily prepared because you procrastinated.
Right.
And that always angers me as an audience member. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you should pre-apologize in general for talks, but that one in particular really just makes me want to get up and leave.
Right. And then the amount of time that is actually required in order to be prepared for the talk, we're not talking weeks and weeks. We're talking go do it a couple of times in your hotel room, practice in front of maybe a mirror, or just actually walk through it a couple of times and maybe give it to a small group of people that you know.
Yeah, it totally depends who you are, I think, how mm-hmm. much prep you need and what you're talking about. Like the RailsConf talk I wrote the night before
mm-hmm.
and I think came out really well and people mm-hmm. raved about it. But I knew I could do that for that talk because of right. how long I had been thinking. So people asked me, how long did it take you to make that talk? And I said, well, it took me 2 hours to write it and 3 years of giving a dozen conference talks per year to write that talk.
Right.
So for something that I have a lot of expertise and passion about, I can do it. I can get away with less prep. Sometimes it is a crazy amount of preparation. The live coding stuff takes a long time. And for instance, Katrina Owen, who has done a handful mm-hmm. of not mm-hmm. even live coding talks, but sort of live showing talks on a slide on slides, preps for like inhuman amounts of time, like 100 hours. So it depends on who you are and the level of polish and detail you want to get to and what you're talking about.
So you mentioned that speaking at conferences, and the work you do there helps you learn. So what else do you do to learn?
It's programming stuff in particular?
Yeah, programming stuff in particular.
Yeah. It's the best thing I've found so the very best thing I've found ever for learning programming stuff is to pair with people that are mm-hmm. pair with people, period. People that are better, people that are not quite as good. That I think is the highest form of learning bandwidth for programming. Beyond that, I really like to tackle exercises to give mm-hmm. myself problems to solve and try to do them. Like I've been learning Clojure recently, and so I've been on this forclojure.org site that has practice problems that come with tests, and then you get them. Once you solve something, you can see other people's solutions to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned a lot for that. And I've also noticed like there's this temptation where I do things where I feel like I'm learning, but I'm really not. It's like I really like to read about Clojure, and I really like to watch talks about it
mm-hmm.
because they both kind of feel like I'm learning, and they both are on topics that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, not a lot of learning is going on. Like when I sit down at the computer, that stuff is not very useful, not nearly as useful as taking 10 hours to write tic-tac-toe.
Mm-hmm. So you've been learning Clojure?
I have.
Do you like it?
I love it. It's interesting to work in a new paradigm. Mm-hmm. So it's functional programming instead of object-oriented programming.
Had you done any functional programming before?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I had done a little bit of Scheme in school, but that was about it. So we had like a functional programming week, I guess, in that mm-hmm. class. This is new for me. And that's what I love. Like I'm a bit of a new addict. Like I need to change directions or things every so often. Being able to step into a new world where like all the OO stuff gets thrown out is like, ooh, cool. Yeah, let's try this.
Yeah. One of the listeners asked why there's been nothing on the blog yet about Clojure.
That's a good question. I assume by the blog he means our blog.
Yeah, yeah.
That would probably be okay, right? We could mm-hmm. do that.
Yeah.
It's weird. Ruby is such the lingua franca of Thoughtbot that it feels almost weird to bring in Clojure.
Yeah.
I guess I haven't really gotten any pushback from anybody. Like everyone's kind of down with
learning it. I think it'd be good if there's any reason why it probably feels weird. It's because we're not doing professional work in it.
Yeah.
And that's, almost everything that is on the blog, even if it's somewhat academic, comes from something that we hit upon or discovered in our work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. I definitely learn a lot by writing blog posts on things. Mm-hmm. So I think I could add that to my queue.
And we often say that, people say, we say, start a blog. If you're learning, start a blog. It's a great way to build reputation and just learn.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, but I just learned this. It's, and we tell them, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Someone's 1 week behind you.
Exactly. Yeah. I have this secret plan. I'll disclose my secret plan here.
Yes.
My secret plan is to make it so that we can use Clojure professionally someday. Mm-hmm. I think there are some things about functional programming and Clojure in particular that solve pain points that we've had in the object-oriented world. And I think it may actually be the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of want to sneak it in here somehow. And so I think maybe blogging is probably a good way to add it to that list.
Yeah. I mean, I say it all the time that, we were very fortunate to enjoy Ruby, enjoy Rails, switch to it very early on,
mm-hmm.
and have it then become very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to miss the next thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if that next thing is Clojure, so be it.
And that, by the way, is a great part about being here, is that there's, in everything, not even just programming language choice, I feel like we have a pretty healthy willingness to try new things and mm-hmm. to change. And I like that a lot as someone that's sort of addicted to change. There's very little pushback, like, well, this is how we do it now, and so that's how we do it.
Right, and when I hear that, I try to get rid of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know how secret this is, but I've said that I think this year we will do one major project that is not Ruby.
Mm.
I don't know what it will be,
mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't surprise me if it's not Ruby.
Yeah, cool.
Hopefully, and that will be because we're choosing it for the right reasons, not just to use something new.
Yeah, it's interesting balancing act that I was talking to Joe about this, where you have to kind of always be trying new things, but you also have to balance that against, like, we charge for our time.
Right. And not only do we charge for our time, but we charge as expert. Like, we've gotten ourselves into a position where when people work with Thoughtbot, they expect expertise.
For sure. Yeah. And so you have to try the new thing so you don't miss out on the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little bit of a business challenge to figure out how much do you charge for it and all that. And because we can't promise, like, we think Clojure is the right choice and we can promise it's going to be awesome and high quality. Like, we might get into it and feel it and realize it's not.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a tricky situation.
And languages are different than, it was very easy for us to say, we think MongoDB is the right solution for this. It's a new technology, but we're gonna do it. And without that expertise in MongoDB previously,
mm-hmm.
There's a whole nother level when it involves the actual language that your application is programming, and that also means the frameworks and
mm-hmm.
and everything.
And that's a good example, by the way, because MongoDB turned out to be a terrible choice, and no one should use it ever. Sorry, Mongo people. I mean that mostly facetiously.
Mostly, no, like everything. Most technical things, they have their place.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when we finally do use something besides Ruby or Rails, we want to look back on it and say that was the right decision, or we at least made the decision thinking it was the right one.
Oh, yeah,
not sure. Just because we wanted to try something new, but because we thought it was the right technical choice.
Mm-hmm.
So you're reading a book on Clojure. I've seen it on your desk.
Mm-hmm.
What other things are you doing to learn, and how much time are you spending doing that?
I like I said, I'm falling a little bit into the edutainment trap.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been reading that book is my like third Clojure book. And I'm spending a decent amount of time on it. But less time actually writing code. And so I think I need to course correct on that.
Mm-hmm.
I read and watched fairly liberally, and then started to go write tic-tac-toe, which is playing tic-tac-toe against an AI opponent, and even just getting like, how do I represent the board? How do I like detect when the board is in a winning condition? How do I make moves? Things like that. Like all the simple questions like took me a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I need to totally flip what I'm doing, where like a little bit of code and a lot of reading needs to be the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. There's just no comparison with like trying to get stuff done, even if it seems a little intimidating. Like starting a web app sounds a little bit like, wow, I kind of have no idea where to start. But like, I'm just going to kind of go into it anyway, because that's when you really do a lot of learning.
It strikes me that you're very into self-improvement and being better,
mm-hmm.
not only in the work you do, but, sort of in your life.
Mm-hmm.
you were talking at lunch the other day about this fitness thing you're doing, or this health thing that you're going to be doing.
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, it seems along those same lines. So for those who weren't at lunch with us.
There's only a few people that weren't at lunch with us, but just for those people, I'll explain it. So I purchased this thing through a company called Wellness FX, where you go to their site and then they give you a lab order and you go get your blood drawn. And then they basically run a battery of tests on it, and then the test results get sent to Wellness FX and they feed them into a nice looking web app. And then for all those things, they tell you like, okay, your whatever level is here, it really should be here and whatnot. And I also purchased like a consult with a nutritionist. So like mm-hmm. they sort of help you interpret the results. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of just like an interesting way to get some data points on like where your body is at that you can't necessarily guess. And like I've heard there's interesting stories like someone like, I didn't realize I was not getting nearly enough vitamin E. And so I like took a ton of it for a while. And now I feel like a new person. And like, mm-hmm. it's intriguing to me to like, I wonder if I have like some weird thing that like I have a major mineral deficiency and I have no idea. And if I just started taking zinc, I would program two times as fast and switch to Emacs or something.
So is it about fixing problems or is it about just becoming better? Or maybe both?
I guess it's both. For me, for this thing in particular, I'm mostly worried about something that's really wrong.
Okay.
Like I think I eat decently well. I get a decent amount of exercise, but maybe I'm totally wrong on those evaluations. And in mm-hmm. fact, I eat terribly and need way more exercise. And these numbers will make that clear. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather, it's sort of just an early detection system to me right now mm-hmm. before something bad happens and I blow up in some way.
Mm-hmm. You did a lot of traveling last year for both conferences and, I guess, pleasure.
Yeah.
You like to travel, right?
It's really funny. So so I'm single, and so I go on OkCupid, and I look at people's profiles, and there's like, if there's one common word that spans every single profile, it's like travel. It's like this love mm-hmm. of travel. Apparently, it's like the cool thing to say. You like traveling.
Isn't it like studies show that that's what you should say in your dating profile or something
probably.
Like that?
Probably. I mean, it's... I think everyone thinks that, in fact, it conveys no information because everyone says it.
Right.
So it conveys nothing. But I think I'm going to actually be the first person on OkCupid to say I'm sick of traveling.
Right.
So like last year, I just burnt myself out a little bit too mm-hmm. much. I had some things where I would like be in Europe and then back. And then 2 weeks later, I'm like back in Europe somewhere else. And it was amazing for a while. And the fact that I could do this on like while doing conference speaking was awesome. And I really enjoyed the heck out of it for a while. And then just kind of solo travel in particular, like solo international travel on long haul flights, like just I'm super extroverted. And so like being mm-hmm. alone for like 9 days or 8 days just like started to get to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I wasn't having fun doing it anymore. So I basically sort of canceled the next couple appearances I had and then have been turning things down recently. And so I think I will return to the circuit eventually because I really enjoy it. But I need to do it in a sustainable way.
So what you need to do is keep it in your OkCupid profile that yeah. you love to travel.
Yeah.
And then become not single. And then you'll have someone to travel
that's,
with.
That's kind of the plan, actually. That's the secret plan is like, if I'm traveling with people, I'm totally happy. It doesn't even have to be like a significant other. Just even mm-hmm. a friend makes it like to me 10 times as good. But like I think the thing that really did it for me was like 10 days in Australia mm-hmm. after like a massive flight. And like it was really amazing and fulfilling and interesting, but like I just got to the point where I was like basically depressed on vacation. And I was like, something is wrong here. I was like, I don't even want to leave my hotel and I'm in Sydney and like this is silly. So mm-hmm. I need to figure out what's going on.
So is that why you have roommates?
Yeah, actually. Yeah, it is. Empty houses do not appeal to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the why some people want that, but it's not my style.
Mm-hmm. Except you want your own hotel room.
That is true. Yeah, that's true. We had a trip scheduled where you and I were supposed to room together.
Yeah.
And I got to the hotel. I was just like, no, I want my own room, damn it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an adult and I want it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Just.
Well, it's funny because I was feeling the same way. So on the flight there, I was like, you know, we don't need to stay in the same room. It's
yeah.
fine.
Yeah.
And then I landed. You had gotten there a little bit before me. And there was an email from you saying, I got my own room.
And you were like, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to me, it's like, yeah, hotel rooms are small,
mm-hmm.
and like it's like you're sharing a bedroom. It's mm-hmm. it's as opposed to like sharing an apartment where you have your own private space.
Very intimate.
It's very intimate, and like it's like I'm sharing a hotel room with my boss for like 3 days. I was like, I'm just gonna, you know, not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I did.
It's very fun to stay in a hotel room with me, Ben.
I'm not sure it is. It's nothing personal.
No, and I knew that. And because I was feeling similarly, it all worked out. And I think that separation between work and life and being alone and with people, like, you know, it seems like to me, like you mentioned, I'm an ex. You state these things about yourself. It seems like you have an understanding about who you are.
Mm.
And you're not afraid to sort of live that.
Mm. Yeah. And hopefully I'm right about these things.
And when you're wrong, you adjust, right?
Yeah, I mean,
you travel
a
bunch and then you got tired of it and now you're not.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think it's the reason I say that is because I think self-awareness is the hardest kind of awareness.
Mm.
Like it's easiest to accidentally, to have blind spots around yourself. And so I state these things, but I also try to have a healthy dose of like, is that definitely true? And I should check that against real world data.
Mm-hmm. So what do you wish that I had asked that I haven't asked? What do you want your legacy to be?
Oh gosh. You're stealing my questions. My legacy, I don't know if I care if I have a legacy.
Yeah.
I kind of want to do good and interesting things and have great friends and love and all that around me. And I don't necessarily care if I don't change the world in an extremely lasting way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's okay. I think I'd be all right with that. As long as I sort of enjoy what I've done here and generally made the immediate space around me better, like for my coworkers and for my friends and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's okay. I'm down with that.
We'll see if that changes over time.
Yeah, it could be.
Is there anything that you wish I had asked that you wanted to talk about?
You know, I have kind of been sneaking in barbershop references to...
Oh, yeah. Actually, it's right here.
To podcasts
for I just a while. Can't read my handwriting.
Right. Slanging.
So, yeah. So you sing.
I do.
You are in a... You run a barbershop quartet that you are also in, right?
I'm in the... So the quartet is sort of egalitarian.
Okay.
It's equal, but I'm the assistant director of a chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's interesting. So I thought we might segue there from the speaking because my being, so as an assistant director, you're in front of the chorus a lot. So I'm in front of like 50 people week to week and, you know, sort of leading them through things. And so it's been amazing to me how much the speaking has helped make my job as an assistant director better and vice versa.
Now, are you just assistant director and that means you don't sing in the chorus or you also sing?
I also sing. Mm-hmm. So I sing when I'm not directing basically.
Right.
There's a frontline director and he directs the majority of the things. And so I contribute vocally when I'm...
How long have you been singing for?
A long time. I grew up in like a singing household. It's like, so my mom's...
Singing salesman.
No, actually not my dad. So my dad didn't. My mom grew up with... my grandfather is also a barbershopper, as they're known. And so she grew up in a household where they sang as children. And so I grew up in a household where we started singing as children and like a cappella Christmas carols kind of thing. And just like... a lot of singing in my life. So I joined my first chorus at like 6 or something and have basically been in getting some sort of chorus or vocal instruction since then, more or less.
So you've taken actual vocal instruction classes.
Yep. Yep. A handful. It's interesting to me. So there's this weird thing about singing where people think they're terrible at it or they think they should be good at it naturally. And it's weird because no one, if you were like a cello player and had been taking cello lessons all your life and someone heard you and said, wow, you're amazing. And then they said, I could never do that.
Right.
You'd be like, well, yeah, you could. You know, you'd like, no, no, I tried and I'm terrible. Well, like how many lessons did you take? Well, I took none. I just started trying to do it and I wasn't good at it. And you're like, well, that's pretty stupid sounding. But this happens with singing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure why. I think because people assume you should naturally be good at singing.
Oh, it's something natural in our body. Like,
right, so exactly. You should just know how to use it,
right.
Just like everything else. But in fact, there's quite a... I mean, there's people get PhDs in vocal performance. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of knowledge to get. And I have been getting it for a long, long time. And so people are like, oh, you're a great singer, but I could never do that. I'm like, well, if you had lived the life I've lived, you would also have this level of skill at 30. And so I always do just ask people, they're like, oh, I could never do that. I'm like, oh, like when was your last lesson? I'm like, well, never. It's like, oh, well, like, I think I know why you're not very good at it. No one that has ever showed you how.
Right.
And it's the thing that you actually do need to be shown how.
And like programming, a chorus is a great way to, this is sort of like the singing hack, because if you get in a decent chorus, especially one, you know, it doesn't, there are good choruses that you don't need to, audition for,
mm-hmm.
you know, decent choruses.
Mm-hmm.
You get in and you're going to be surrounded by people. You're going to be able to sing in a group and it's going to sound amazingly good to you,
mm-hmm.
but then you'll learn to read music faster, get better at the singing, the songs that you're singing, which then makes it easier to sing the next song where the director hands out the
Absolutely.
New song. So that's like a hack. So like if you're, this is a life hack for singing. is you can do it in the same way that you can do programming. You can get started with it and then surround yourself with it and get better by actually doing it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And our chorus, so barbershop is a decidedly amateur hobby. Mm-hmm. Like it's very welcoming to people that have never had formal training in it. So I was a bit of an anomaly coming into this, having done so much singing in more formal settings and had formal voice lessons. But we take all the time people that are fairly raw and teach them how to do it. And like I'll actually teach like one-on-one voice lessons. I'll pull guys out of the chorus and like take them out into a room and like just do a quick like 30-minute session with them. And we also teach a lot as they're on the risers. And just sort of you like that life hack applies to most things. If you want to learn to do a thing and you go to a place where a bunch of other people are doing a thing, some of which are better than you, you're going to learn to do that thing faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do audition people, but we take very much into account their potential. And we realize that when people do enter the chorus and come regularly, they learn a lot and they become better over time.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me, just going back for one second to this like idea of people not learning to sing, where there's so many people that have had a scarring experience at an early age when it comes to singing. So like I have a lot of guys that come into the chorus, and when they were 10, they had a school assembly and they were supposed to sing some song, and the teacher told them, "You're not good, like don't sing, like just mouth the words." Or like a parent heard them when they were 7 in the car and said, "You're mm-hmm. not good." And there's something about vocal criticism that people mm-hmm. take and it sticks with them forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have these like 55-year-old guys that when they were 10 years old were told they couldn't sing. And so for 45 years, they didn't. And they believed that and they carried that around. And then they come to my course and I'm like, "Well, when was your last voice lesson?" And they're like, "Well, never." And so we start teaching them how to sing. And what happens is eventually they decide, "I don't care about this stupid thing that I've been carrying around. I want to sing, and so I'm going to try it." And they realize they can, and they can learn it. But there's something about singing where so many people got damaged early on and they just held that for so long and believed it is true. And so there's this great saying, my mom's a therapist, and one of her favorite things is, "Don't believe everything you think," which I really like. You got to question those things. Like, you might be carrying around that or something similar, and just because you've thought it for a long time does not mean it's true.
Well, I think that about does it.
Okay. Awesome.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
If you...
you got it. If you'd like to access...
You have notes, and I don't have notes. Now, if you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to podcast.thoughtbot.com/giantrobots/83. You can follow Ben at R00K on Twitter, and of course follow ThoughtBot on Twitter. And if you like this episode, we really appreciate it if you go to iTunes and rate it. It really helps us find new listeners for the show. And thank you very much for listening.